Cheers.
With all the enthusiasts.
Those first, you know, couple songs you played, I wanted to give those to everybody else, but I don't necessarily go back and listen to myself play saxophone that much. I like to keep it kind of like I let it go, and then I try not to listen to it too much. But the beats that I produce is much the opposite. It's like I'm making that to commemorate a memory a lot of times.
Hello and welcome to Pour Me a Mozart. I am here with my co-host, Patty Ryan.
And I'm here with my co-host, Asia Myshak.
Hi, Patty.
Hello.
And cheers.
Cheers.
How are you today?
I'm doing well. Getting ramped up to go to Houston. I have about a 10-day trip to Texas, and I'm going to be performing in Houston and in San Antonio and just visiting Austin, but it's a big mental game of making sure you have everything prepared, like everything, your life in, you know, in the Twin Cities is, you know, you're putting it down for a few days and, you know, your cat's okay. And I feel like I sort of vortex over to Texas and then that's like a whole other biome in some way. And so I'm looking forward though. It's always a blast when I go down. How about you? How are you doing?
I'm good. I'm kind of in the wind down mode of my season. I have a few things going on this weekend, and then just like another week and a half of teaching, and then it's weddings all summer.
Yeah, well, that's a whole other kind of wedding season.
Well, I should say it's weddings and charanga all summer.
Right, which that's exciting. Yeah, that's
always exciting. Fun. Yeah, so I think this will happen. Shoot, I don't remember when the Salsa Fiesta is. Maybe it's the end of July. Let me look this up. This is kind of a big deal. Doug Little, the band leader, wants this to be like the salsa event in the Midwest. And it's held at the Mill City Museum. Mm-hmm. And last year it was a really good time. We got to play on this huge outdoor stage, and this band is really well suited to outdoors because it is loud.
Yeah. No, it's a lot of fun though. I went last year and we had a blast.
Yeah.
And just watching everyone salsa dance. I do my own little silly dance, but like there's actually people that show up and know what they're doing, and it's really fascinating to watch. And yeah.
Yeah. The dancers are incredible. It is Saturday, July 29th at the Mill City Museum in Minneapolis. So yeah. And then we're playing at a vineyard and ice house and other such things.
Yeah, well, those kinds of gigs are always kind of fun, though. Mm-hmm. Like out of the ordinary a little bit, yeah.
Yeah, I get to let loose a little bit. And actually, I'm excited to ask our guest, Jason, today a few questions about improvising. Mm. So I guess now would be a good time to kind of introduce him before he gets here. We went to the U of M together, and we were in the same year, and we were in many of the same, like, introductory theory and piano classes. And after like years of not talking, I started seeing his stuff kind of pop up on social media. And he has this incredible career out in Los Angeles, writing music and gigging as a saxophonist and vocalist and actually all sorts of other things. Mm-hmm. And anytime I get to have a conversation with someone who is so comfortable with improvising, that's something that I just like, tell me more, help me please.
Yeah.
Because that's like something I've been encouraged to do in this band, but haven't quite felt brave enough to do it, I guess.
Totally. It's like a superpower, I feel like. And it's something that it's always, everything's teachable, right? I also would panic in that situation of like, what am I supposed to improvise? Can you put music in front of me and I'll do it? Like, yeah.
Right. Yeah. And I've talked to a few other jazz musicians about why improvising is so scary. And I think I find, you know, freedom within a phrase. I find freedom interpreting articulations and like, how does my vibrato lead the note somewhere else? And like, it's not like I'm just playing the notes on the page, but it's like, I take that and I do something else. Mm-hmm. And I guess kind of like improvising, whether or not it's successful, like depends on the moment, but it's so much I don't know, maybe I just feel much more comfortable with those smaller scale things where I know the notes and the rhythms will probably still sound pretty good.
Right, right. Yeah, well, I'm looking forward to meeting him soon.
Yeah. Let's welcome Jason Fabus to Pour Me a Mozart. Thank you for being here today.
Cheers, yes, ladies.
Yeah, cheers.
Cheers.
Thank you for having me.
So I guess we did this unrecorded, but how are you today?
Well, as I said earlier, before we hit record, I'm doing great. And it's good to see you again, Asia. We went to school, undergraduate together back in, I don't even know what year.
2007.
And Patty, I just met you. And the two of you seem like a dynamic duo.
Yeah, well, you're actually in my old stomping grounds. I went to undergrad at USC.
Aha, okay.
And I'm from San Diego originally, so.
Oh, I love San Diego.
If you're living in the West Coast, I feel that beach vibe going.
Are you both in Minneapolis or St. Paul or what?
Well,
St. Paul.
And in Minneapolis. So we got the Twin Cities here representing. Yeah.
Broadcasting live from the Twin Cities.
Oh, yes.
Okay, well, I have a trivia question then for Asia.
Okay.
Because you're from Minnesota originally, mm-hmm. right?
Yep.
So what were the original Twin Cities before Minneapolis and St. Paul?
Ooh.
Because one of those cities is much older than the other.
Wait, what?
No looking it up on Google.
I don't know.
The problem is I don't know the answer.
Oh, which city is older?
I figured you might know because you're from out there. So
St. Paul is older.
Yes, yeah, St. Paul's much older than Minneapolis. So before Minneapolis was named a city, there were two cities called the Twin Cities in Minnesota, and it was St. Paul and a different city. I think, was it Hudson? No, that's Wisconsin.
Well, they don't like to identify as being in Wisconsin. No, yelled at by choir kids for that once.
In Hudson?
Mm-hmm.
They have no reason to be yelling in Hudson.
I mean, I took it probably more personally than they said it.
They have, I guess they're kids. I was going to say they have access to all the Wisconsin beer that we can't have access to, like New Glarus and stuff. But then I'm like, wait, kids. Yeah.
So I'm trying to look this up and now I feel like it's backfiring on me and maybe I'm just spinning conspiracy theories.
Are they close to each other?
I just had always heard that there was an original two big cities in Minnesota that were close enough. And they were called the Twin Cities. But now I'm not so sure. Well, I'm sure all of your listeners from the Twin Cities are going to come after me on social media.
Yes.
Somebody will have an answer.
I'm sure.
So, audience, we're asking you, please clear this up.
So on that note, or totally not on that note, what are we drinking today?
I was very happy that you let me choose the drink. I thought you might want to. We're doing a drink that I call the Gregory. It's named after a fictional character, Gregory the Grapefruit.
Okay.
So it's like a long story, so I won't get into it, but it's an inside joke between me and my original roommates. But we live in a house in Cypress, California, which is right on the Orange County, LA border. And we have two fruit trees in our backyard, and they both have grapefruits, but they're not the common red grapefruit, ruby red grapefruit that most people get. They're called white grapefruits. They actually are really good for juicing and really good for drinks. So this is a drink that has, it's a twist on a Greyhound. So it has grapefruit, but from white grapefruit. And then we're doing vodka. And I'd love to hear what types of vodkas we picked up. Then you finish it with a little bit of club soda. And then I usually garnish it with a lime. And I don't know if we're doing video on this. And I'm so sorry, I have no lime garnish. So I cheated and did like a little bit of that squeezable lime.
Isn't there also agave in it?
Oh, yes. And you sweeten it with agave.
Yeah. So I actually haven't tried it yet.
Me neither. Yeah.
Patty texted me right before we got on here and was like, what's the recipe? And I was like, I don't know.
It's pretty simple. Like it's a pretty simple drink. It's good for like, we just like it like sitting outside on a summer's night. You know, it's like that type of vibe.
Yeah.
But like the ounceage.
No. I have no rule on that. That's just dealer's choice. Yeah.
Okay.
So that can get dangerous quick.
Hey, it's up to the pourer.
I just followed what Asia kind of guided me. So
yeah. So I did an ounce and a half of vodka, half an ounce of agave nectar, which I've actually never used before. I tried it. It's very sweet. That might be too much.
Uh-oh.
And then like an ounce of grapefruit, which ended up being kind of perfect. I actually don't know how to juice a grapefruit. Mine was gigantic.
They're big. Yeah. They're
huge. Yeah.
Well, you have so to cut them.
The little quarter was like.
Yeah, you got to cut them into pieces. So yeah, I should apologize to our listeners if they're all up on their cocktails, because I know anybody who's good at making cocktails is all about measurements and following the recipe. I generally don't do that, which probably sums up who I am as a person, but I just like to kind of eyeball it. But agave nectar is going to be a good sweetener for a lot of different cocktails. You could use it for old fashions, especially if you want to do it with tequila. A tequila old fashioned with some agave would be good. And then also it's going to go really good for like margaritas, if you're trying to sweeten up a margarita. So whatever you bought, hang on to it, because you could use it in a future cocktail, Asia.
So will do. I actually wanted to make a point about I got a different agave nectar. It's agave nectar, but it's blue agave nectar. Because okay. I went to the local co-op, and I was looking at, there's like a couple of varieties, and this one happened to be on like $1 off. And I was like, well, I'll just try it. Why not? So as I was pouring the drink, I mean, maybe this is just psychosomatic, but as I was pouring the drink, I thought I saw like a tint of blue as I was pouring. And I was like, oh, that's kind of cool. But I have, I was saving to try the drink so that we'd all try it together. Or at least Asia and I would try it together.
Oh my gosh, I'm so sorry.
Oh, you took a sip. Oh, well, yeah. Here we go. Cheers.
Yeah, cheers, y'all.
Cheers.
Oh, Patty, that looks so good.
Right?
Yeah, for the video, I definitely got your garnish for you. So don't worry about that.
Oh, that looks, yeah, that is how you dress it up. And you know what? Now I'm jealous. I mean, as much as I like the taste of white grapefruit, it doesn't have anywhere near like the color.
Right.
Like, that drink has sex appeal because of the pink. It looks good.
It does.
So like I would have to add something to this, like a blue curacao or something that would like brighten it up maybe.
Right.
Yeah, or a garnish. But honestly, I'm like not super into garnishes.
Yeah.
I can attest that at a restaurant, they are not usually super well cared for. And I find they just get in the way of drinking the drink more often.
As you're watching me take a sip.
Yeah.
And I'm like, don't hit my nose.
It's how you present it, right? It's like, like, I don't want to have to wear a 3-piece suit and a hat and a, you know, every day.
But on the flip side, isn't it also part of the aroma as you're inhaling to take a sip that you get a hit of the citrus?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're fancy living, Patty. I get it. You're living on a higher level.
I try my best.
Are like, let's just get straight to the alcohol.
I mean, I can be that girl too. Trust.
Okay.
Asia knows.
Yeah. Well, Patty just takes the pictures for me, so her drink always looks the best.
Well, I try to dress it up a little bit, but
yeah,
it looks good.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So I used the vodka I used was the Prairie vodka, the local one. It was residual from a previous episode. So I'm still working on that bottle.
Do you know if it's potato or?
It's grain.
Grain. Yeah. Yeah. Asia, how about you?
I also used the vodka from last episode, Chopin, which is a potato vodka. And on last episode, I was finally convinced that there is a difference between vodka brands.
Okay. Let me hear it.
I just thought vodka was totally tasteless and had no flavor profile. And I was proven wrong.
Yeah. It's kind of like a Pilsner beer. They're not trying to flavor them or make any of them different. Pilsner beers are going after one thing, and it's the same with vodka, and it's a pretty simple thing to go for. So to pick out the difference is tough, but if you really get nitpicky about it, you can find it. And so I think there's definitely a difference between potato and wheat, like grain vodka, but I like them both. So like one of my favorite vodkas is Grey Goose. If I can get it on sale at the grocery store, I'll buy Grey Goose. And people out there who know anything about Kirkland, which is, of course, our Costco brand, they'd know that that's where you can get Grey Goose quality, pretty much the same stuff in a larger bottle for way less. And also, I know this for a fact because I used to be a poor jazz musician. You don't need to have a Costco membership in order to buy alcohol. You can still go in there and get alcohol. So enjoy that, listeners. All that to say that I have Kirkland as my vodka of choice.
Nice.
So Kirkland, the American or the French? Do you know? Is it blue or is it red?
This, the Kirkland I have is the American one. It's the cheaper one.
Yeah.
Because I think we had it from a leftover party or something.
Sure. Those bottles are like, you don't want to get smacked in the head with one of those. Those things are huge.
Yeah. You can weightlift with them. Yeah.
Yeah. Seriously. Yeah.
Nice. Like, cheers, y'all. I hope you enjoy it.
Yeah. Thanks.
It's a little taste of SoCal.
Mine is the white grapefruit.
But yo, you guys are getting great weather out there right now, aren't you?
Oh yeah.
It might as well be San Diego right now. Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
That's the best.
Yeah.
There's the people in the Midwest. They're so much more like grateful for the weather changing, and they just pay more attention to it because it's a bigger part of your life. And totally. So I know people will say like, SoCal is the best weather and we're spoiled. That's true. We have really good weather, but I just noticed people don't talk about it. It's not a part of our life. And there's so much more like community around the Midwest, because you could literally just bump into a stranger and say, how about this weather lately? And that's a conversation you can have.
Yeah. Growing up in San Diego, I was just like, eye roll, another sunny day. Like, really? I'm getting kind of bored. Like, can we have at least some rain or something? And that's like, you know, on the other side of, you know, privilege of some way of having good weather, but living in it, sometimes it kind of gets a little boring. So in some ways, I really enjoy the changing of the seasons now living here for 5 years.
Yeah, it's okay to have a little struggle every now and then, or like something unexpected, honestly. I was just gigging in San Diego 2 nights ago, mm-hmm. and it's this very nice bar in downtown in the Gas Lamp District. Mm-hmm. And the bartender's already saying like, yeah, I don't think a lot of people are going to come out tonight. I hope you don't mind, but we might not have a lot of people because it's just been so cloudy.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. That's a truth. A lot of people think that San Diego's always sunny, but actually it's probably more times than not overcast.
But yeah, still, people don't go out because it's cloudy. Come on, y'all. Go to Minnesota.
Well, seriously. Yeah.
So I was researching the white grapefruit to see whether or not I could get any in Minnesota. And the ruby red is actually a mutation of the white grapefruit. That is the original grapefruit. And the reason white grapefruit is so rare now is because all you get is the ruby red now.
Is the ruby red perhaps a like a dominant trait too? So it's like that Mendel property where like, I'm trying to go back to like fourth grade. But like, so as the years go on, more and more are going to likely be ruby red, and then you start to lose the white. Kind of like blue-eyed people, right?
Yeah, like the pundit square, basically.
Aren't blue-eyed people just the worst?
I know.
I'm kidding. Well,
but that's the recessive gene, yeah.
And pretty soon, they'll all be gone. There's nothing they can do about it.
Yeah, it'll suck.
Sorry, guys.
But yeah, I just think it's interesting when something is much more common and is no longer the original, and that is evolution for you.
Yep.
Before we move on to talking about you, Jason, I just wanted to, as I was making your drink, I was thinking to myself, why haven't Asia and I made a cocktail for Pour Me a Mozart?
Mm.
You know what I mean? Why haven't we collaborated and tried to like make a Pour Me a Mozart cocktail?
I mean, we can try it.
So do you usually research other cocktails online and then you pick them?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Improvise a little bit.
Yeah, we should come up with a Pour Me a Mozart cocktail.
Hell yeah. So what would the base be?
Probably gin.
I was going to say, I think it's going to be gin. It's going to be probably a Negroni, on the Negroni side of things. Yeah. So it'll be a little bit bitter. Maybe we'll use agave syrup. I don't know.
Well, yeah. I had a friend who's a very good cocktail guy, and he said in a Negroni, it's usually Campari, right? Mm-hmm. He said try it with Cappelletti, which is another Italian... Oh. Similar to Campari, but it's called Cappelletti, and it's just sweeter. It's less bitter, a little more sweet. So it's a twist.
Okay. Interesting.
Yeah, but we'll have to keep thinking about that, Asia, okay? So we should, mm-hmm. by the end of this season, maybe we'll come up with a season Mozart, signature cocktail or something.
Where's Mozart from? Was he Austria?
Salzburg.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So Salzburg. So what are they drinking in Salzburg?
I wouldn't know.
Was trinkt man in Salzburg? Yeah, beer. Throw a little beer in the cocktail, maybe.
Yeah, beer tail.
You could do it. Yeah.
But yeah, season finale. We should
make maybe a cocktail. That's the time.
That's the time.
I will look forward to what you come up with.
Hey, and then when you come visit, we'll make you one.
Yeah, that's a deal. I will try. I'm definitely going to come out there and I'll let you know. So we'll at least meet for drinks. And if I bring a white grapefruit, you'll have to mention it on a podcast.
Pay $30 for it.
Two for 30.
Oh, okay.
It's a deal. Okay. Yeah. Cool.
Glad we got that all ironed out.
Yeah.
So let's talk about you, Jason. I'm curious to know about your personal music journey. Of course, I know your main instrument and I mentioned it, but main instrument, any other instruments, influential teachers along the way?
Yeah, I don't want to go too long with it because it probably runs like a similar script with a lot of other musicians. I started in fifth grade on alto saxophone. And to this day, that's still what I consider my voice. It's my truest voice. And then I was a total band geek, marching band, jazz band through high school, did it all. By the time I went to school, I chose University of Minnesota, which was cool because to this day, I think there's still reciprocity between Minnesota and Wisconsin schools. So it encourages kids to take that leap to go one state away and get away from the parents and see a new city. And I was really glad to go to Minnesota and see Minneapolis. The only culture shock there for me was joining a prestigious university that was still running very much like a classical conservatory. And that includes for the saxophone studio, where nowadays most saxophone players are doing commercial music and jazz studies and all that stuff. It really was a different approach at Minnesota, and my entire class and colleagues and students were all very classically trained because we had the greatest saxophone teacher of all time, Mr. Eugene Rousseau. I should say Dr. Eugene Rousseau there. And so that was a huge learning and growth moment for me of at first hating it. And I know hate's a strong word, but I use it sparingly. I hated it at first because it just was not what I wanted to do and I didn't get it. And I also didn't respect it. And I didn't know anything about it. And through the program, through the 5 years, I completely 180'd, and I love it. I value it. I'm grateful today that my studies in classical saxophone from one of the best instructors of all time has allowed me to sound like who I sound like, which is, it's honestly
That's
me.
The gift.
It's, I'm just, yeah.
So I'm kind of curious. You didn't know that you were going to go into a classical environment at all. You're kind of like thrown in the deep end of that arena. And what made you continue to stick through it? And why did you not like switch out or try to do something different, transfer, any of those rationale?
A big reason why I didn't always know what to do. And I must say to this day, I was always very influenced and cohorts with a best friend of mine, Mr. Nelson Devereaux, who is still the best saxophone player in the Twin Cities right now. As long as he's there, he's always on tour. But me and Nelson were buddy-buddy. We were friends since seventh grade in Wisconsin and went out to that school together. So we were always kind of hand-in-hand on a lot of these decisions. And we got to a point where we were dead set on auditioning at other places and leaving. And we thought that was, we were going to win, and we figured it out. And then we stayed. We ended up getting to the end of all that and just realizing it's starting to work. We're starting to get better. We're starting to fill in this scene. We're making friends. Let's just not throw it away. Let's finish this. And if anything, I say this to any younger student that wants to keep doing this, it's going to go like that. You're going to have years where you hate it or you disagree with it, or you don't even respect a teacher probably. Just take it as a lesson to push through and see it out and do it respectfully. You'll always end up still being true to yourself and finding, you know, your voice through it. So
yeah,
we stayed there and I'm glad that we did.
Yeah. It's just interesting to me to ask someone who wasn't really originally from the classical vein, because, you know, both Asia and I were both from the get-go. We knew what the conservatory lifestyle was supposed to look like and what theory class and what are all skills and et cetera, et cetera. Very rarely do classical musicians cross over to other genres, or we do so maybe in the vein of movie music, or maybe in the vein of like, you know, this random band gig or something like that. But rarely do we ever actually just go to school for something else completely separate than classical music. So I can't imagine, I mean, I can only imagine what you know, getting kind of tousled right into that lane of classical music and its, you know, discipline and its, you know, precision and all these things that are like seemingly anti-creative in some way. I'd be curious.
Or like a, almost like a block, like a wall in front of what you've already been doing.
Right.
But if, you know, as I look back on it now, I don't even want to say that I came into that school as a jazz musician. I sucked at jazz too. I just sucked. When I look at it back at it now, like I had a lot of disadvantages coming into that school. That first year was a struggle. Asia, do you remember, it was music history. That was my biggest struggle. Freshman music history, eight in the morning.
Yeah. Also the worst times
in the morning,
the worst times.
Yeah. That's, but I think that, I think schools know that they're like, we're going to teach these kids a lesson about playing gigs at night or going out to parties and getting hung over. And they're going to have to come to one of the most difficult classes at 8 a.m. So like freshman year history, I didn't know any of that stuff. I just, even my instrument, if we look at the history of the saxophone, it was invented in 1860. So already, I don't know anything in my upbringing about music from the Baroque period or classical period or even other countries. It was pretty much Western American music because saxophone was used sparingly even in Paris and France when it was invented. It got big in the 20s in more American like ragtime music. So I'm already at a disadvantage there.
Or like Picture Center Exhibition is like the one example.
Yeah, there's a few orchestral pieces where you get to hear it. Like La Arcienne is great. And then I'm trying to think there's a couple others. But I think Tchaikovsky, did Romeo and Juliet have some saxophone?
Prokofiev's
Prokofiev,
okay, Prokofiev.
But right, it was like the new sound in the orchestra. It wasn't something that was traditional by any means, right?
And even they probably didn't like it. It's like, but so yeah, freshman year music history. I remember the first test. This was like one of those classes where it was pretty much based on your three exams. You remember that, Asia?
I don't remember that specifically, but we didn't start with music history. We started with, what was it called? Like musicology, something, ethnomusicology. And I was just immediately like, this is stupid, which I regret now, but.
Yeah, we always look back on it with a little bit more scope, but there was like three big tests in music history, and I think theory also kind of operated on that way. There's three big exams and they make up over 50% of your weighted grade. And on that first test, I went in thinking I was all good to go, studied, and I got a 60. I got a 60 or a 61, which was a F. And I was like, oh shit, this is the first time in my life like I've gotten a failure, and I'm in college. Right. Like now I already know I have a lot riding on this. I've got money and my future and all that shit. And so I flunk. And I remember calling my mom and freaking out. And I'm like, okay, well, we have another test. Like, let's get better and get this next exam. I shit you not, I studied so hard for that second exam. I put way more effort into it every day, especially with the listening, like having to pick out these songs. The second exam comes back and what did I get? A 55.
Oh no.
I went down. And at that point, I was like, oh fuck. Like, I'm not going to pass this class. So I ended up like somehow figuring it out, or at least like it just, I got lucky. I think on that last exam, I did well enough and I passed, but man, it was cool.
So what happened after the U? How did you end up in California?
I had graduated and I still had another semester left of student teaching so I could finish my ed degree. So I spent one half of a year teaching, and that teacher at the high school even gave me a part-time job for the remainder of the year teaching the jazz bands, which was awesome. And I kind of had my first half year, I would say, 6 months of working a job. I was a valet. So I remember, this is so Minneapolis. I would bike from Uptown to my valet at Target Center or Target Field, valet, run for cars, and then bike back to Uptown.
That's my neck of the woods here. Yeah.
Yeah. Those were good years. I was poor as hell, but I was working my ass off. And then I would gig. I'd try to pick up any gigs and I would teach lessons as well. I had a car and I would drive to teach lessons. And so I had 6 months of it. I really didn't give it long enough in retrospect to see what the Twin Cities would feel like as a working musician trying to make it. But I think I still just wanted another move. you know how a lot of us in college, we tend to move from one year to the next. We're like, it's time to move. It's like, why do we keep moving? We just have it inside of us to like, I want to move. It's like a new year. I want a new place. And so I think that was still burning in me to go to a new place. It was more about moving and seeing a new scene. And so I thought grad school was a wise way to move to a new city. So the way I looked at it was more, I want to check out a new scene. And in order to fit into that scene, I'm going to do 2 years of grad school. You know, it really wasn't even about the degree. It was more like, I want to move and support myself for 2 years and study and meet people along the way and try to figure out if it's going to work.
I honestly, that is something I had to learn kind of the hard way a little bit. I did it the reverse way. I did it because I felt the need like, oh, I'm not ready. I have to go. I must keep studying. I must keep doing this. And yeah, maybe that's part of the that conservatory mindset of like, everyone's always criticizing you about every little nitpicky thing left and right that you're like, oh, well, I must not be good enough if people are still criticizing me, right? And that's obviously like, I'm now like dealing with that kind of stuff now in my own psychology. But I absolutely support that idea of move for whatever city you want to actually plant, like make roots in, especially when you're at that graduate level or postgraduate or any other thing. And I say the same thing to my students. I say, what city do you really want to live in? What city do you want to tap into?
And I ended up picking a Cal State University. I went to California State University, Long Beach. And to this day, I don't want to say it was the only right decision. You can't, there's a saying, you can't make the right decision. You have to make a decision right. So Long Beach for me was a very easy decision because it was where I liked. It was in SoCal. It was a cheaper university that could give me a full ride and allow me to teach as well and have like a bit of a role with the school. And the most important thing was I knew I was studying. I studied with Sal Lozano, who's a saxophonist who lives out here. He knows the LA scene. He plays movie, film, TV scores. He does big band. So I knew that I was moving to an instructor that was going to teach me and help me grow. But also he knew that that wasn't my only priority. I'm going to grow on my own, but he knew how to like train me for this new scene that I was moving to. And so it worked out. It's continuing to work out every day, right?
Yeah, that's invaluable, honestly. When a teacher actually also knows that perspective is, because sometimes teachers are like, no, you must get this like most, you know, at least from my, again,
yeah.
I don't mean to like, you know, shit on conservatory so much.
No. It's more like we're just coming from two different cultures. And yeah. So like, I appreciate you sharing that because I'm curious too.
Yeah. Well, I think at least in my upbringing and going through all these conservatories and major universities and things like that, that a lot of the teachers are very nitpicky and just geared towards performance only. And it's only about like how well you perform in that one moment or how, you know, all these high stakes kind of feeling. And it's like, but then when you exit that school, you realize so much is about networking. So much is about so many other elements about just like day-to-day lifestyle and how do you keep yourself maintained. And I think that's where it's like shows that teacher was really knowledgeable and had the connections for you to be able to do those things. And also Long Beach is like a perfect location to go to Orange County or go up to Los Angeles.
And Long Beach in the last like 10 years, because I've been out here, holy shit, like 10 years now. So in those 10 years, even Long Beach has just continued to rise. More people are moving there. More businesses are moving there. There's plenty of work there. It's become its own scene.
Is there a favorite instrument of yours that you do not play?
There's definitely instruments that I still try to mess around at, but I wish I was a lot better at. So if that counts, I would say I've always, always loved trumpet players. I play just enough trumpet to like mess around, but I've always like, just even looking at pictures of trumpet players like Miles Davis leaning back, like they just look cool when they play. And so much of how they look comes through in their playing. And I just feel like saxophone looks fine, but we make goofy faces and we have weird postures as we get older. Trumpet, man, they can just like clear the whole room out with a big sound and a good look. So
that is true.
What did you want me to say? Violin?
Literally no one has said violin, so it's fine.
I mean,
but I'm
dude,
a recovered trumpet player, so
yeah. I knew that. I knew you played some trumpet.
Oh really?
Yeah. Didn't you play a little bit like at Minnesota? I could have swore you played. You were in an ensemble or something.
I brought it with me. I might have had it out like once. But yeah.
Well, there's your backup plan. If work ever dries up on the string end, you could just start playing lead trumpet.
No one wants to hear that.
But in your defense, Asia, I feel like no one has ever said piano or other instruments that are like very like kind of entryway instruments, because like they're great for a reason. Like people want to learn something else.
That's really nice of you to say, especially because like almost everyone has said cello.
Well, okay. Yeah. But like, that's like, I've grown up. I didn't choose cello because like people said that like I just chose it out of just a natural environment, but I've grown up my entire career being like, oh, I wish I played the cello, or oh, like, you know, all these things. But like, you know, yeah, it's because like it's the alternate thing.
Well, I know from my own perspective too, and if my loving mother Susan is ever watching this podcast, hi mom, love you, but she loves cello players. She just loves the whole look of it, the feel of it.
I mean, there's a physicality around the instrument too, like literally, yeah.
Even the expression, like everybody's doing vibrato, but cello, it just looks bigger because
it's bigger. Right
there. It's bigger, yeah.
Yeah.
So there, I can understand why a lot of people might pick that one too. Maybe I got a little bit of cello.
Cello envy? It's a thing. It's a thing.
Yo, there's your hashtag, cello envy.
Before you got here, we recorded a little bit. When I moved back to Minnesota in like 2014, I was asked to join a charanga band, which is Cuban music.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Three violins, one flute, and then, you know, typical rhythm section. But part of that is I have been more encouraged to improvise. And that is something that is really scary. And obviously something that you do a lot of. So any thoughts, advice about where to get started?
Well, I don't want to get too philosophical, but what we're doing right now is improvising. It's language. And if you can learn to just view it that way, like right now I'm in this moment trying to talk to you and we're having a conversation together. We're listening, we're expressing, and we're also, I don't want to say making things up, because they're not coming out of nowhere, but I'm making improvising decisions in the moment on language that I've learned over the years, which has rules, just like classical music. So everything you learn, everything you go through is what you're improvising. And so, yes, it's not always gonna sound good and you're gonna make mistakes, but it's getting over that hump of like, when you make a mistake, you don't stop, you just keep going. Musically, if we want to get better at improvising, that all comes down to listening. So whether it's going out to live shows to witness it live, or, you know, nowadays students have the ability to go on Spotify or YouTube. And if I want to teach a kid how to play All the Things You Are on saxophone, they can go on to Spotify and find like 20 different versions of it, from singers, instrumentalists, orchestral scores. Like, it's amazing. So you have to just dig in, explore the music. And with somebody with your musical ability already, it's not like you have to start back at square one and learn it from textbooks. I don't think so. Use the knowledge you already have. But you know if you're playing a right note or a wrong note. And then you can figure out how quickly you can fix that, whether it's rhythmically or harmonically. I don't know much about charanga, though.
I know less than I should.
But I think that's really, that inspires me to know that you're doing that. You're putting yourself in a whole nother culture's music. You know, here's this kid from Minnesota playing Cuban music.
Yeah. It's a good time.
That's cool. I did some salsa gigs in South Minneapolis right before I left.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, that was also a whole nother music. It helped that jazz is definitely a big part of salsa music. They go hand in hand, but there's still plenty of difference. And if you open your ears, you can hear it.
First of all, I'm in awe of people who improvise. I seek out jazz music as much as live jazz music as much as possible, because it is something that I feel like I'm not prepared to do. And that's maybe that's already telling of what I'm about to say. Mm-hmm. But I think at the base of all music is a story, or at the base of all music is an expressive story. And from the classical vein, we think of that from the perspective of a composer put down notes on a page because they had something to say and they wrote it down and mm-hmm. they had a feeling that they wanted to in time capsule or something. And mm-hmm. and certain people have been chosen for random reasons or what, or good or bad, to be showcased the most. And most of the time, the good reason is because the story is so universal that everyone can feel and understand that. And it's a matter of putting your own experiences, templating that of who this great composer is or whatever, and then mm-hmm. transcending that and trying to send that message to the audience. That's the classical vein. But
and that's beautiful. That's absolutely beautiful.
And that's its own thing, right? But from the jazz vein or from any improvisation vein, it's like you have your own story but no script, right? In order to improvise, you have to know what you're going to, you have to know an idea or a story or emotional thought before you blow into your saxophone, right?
I think a lot of people would have different answers to that, but it's loaded, but it's
okay.
But from broad strokes perspective, yes, it's very much what I admire about orchestral music in particular is that all these people are getting together to serve this composer. You think about Beethoven or Mozart or Bach sitting down at a piano and writing something with limited voicing, knowing what they want in the big picture is they want all these musicians to get together and create the full version of it. And to this day, hundreds of years later, we're still executing it. Orchestral music is all about serving the composer and executing the music. Those two things, I would still argue, should be preserved in jazz. But it might not be in that order, because number one might be we, the individuals, are here and we're going to converse with each other. And that's why in a lot of jazz music, you just don't see like 100 musicians all getting together and playing a jazz piece. It's smaller. It's more like that pack mentality of we're going to have five, six.
Yeah.
My favorite to this day, I think the best group for jazz, and you could even argue in classical music, it's a trio. Trio is the best way to put out music.
Yeah.
Yeah. Go.
What about a string quartet?
I'll backpedal a little bit, because string quartet, it does have a very true place in my heart. But I mean, when I was thinking in jazz, I love jazz trios.
Oh, yeah.
Because it boils it down to just three people in a room, piano, bass, and rhythm. And that's kind of all you need.
Typically, it could be anything. Like, I've got a trio that might look a little different. But I can honestly tell you to this day, and if you're not a listener of jazz, this would probably be the best place to start, is the piano jazz trio, which is piano, bass, and drums.
But improvising, though, is like, that's where it's like, maybe you start on one note and then you kind of see where that takes you. Is that kind of essentially what improvisation is like? And depending on the tune that you're playing, or depending on, how long you need to improvise in this moment, that's there's certain constructs. It's not form. Yeah.
So you know how in physics they say, like, or you could think mathematically, even just like you're approaching zero. So like if you keep cutting something in half, if you cut eight in half, you're taking four away to make it four. But if you cut four in half, you're taking two in away, right? And if you keep cutting, you're getting so minutely close to zero and yet never hitting zero ever. Like to infinity, you would never hit zero, I think, right? And
right.
We deal with this with black holes as well. Everything's right. Getting sucked into a black hole, but it's never going
Absolute.
All the way.
Yeah.
So when we're approaching zero, I'm using that type of focus with improvisation, where, yes, as a kid, I had books that were telling me lines to play. I was getting melodies put into my head. I was thinking along the way, like, what do I want to play? It was very classical in that way. And now I'm 33 going on 34 in the jazz world, that's considered a freaking baby. I still am approaching zero of like, okay, how can I think less and get more into the just trusting what I've learned over the years, what's under my fingers. And that's again, where I say the two of you can't ignore the fact that you've got all that technique under your fingers. That needs to be there.
I mean, that's a great audition mentality too that I just don't have.
What do you mean?
Oh, I second guess everything.
Like during the audition or, oh, yeah, or leading up to it?
Both.
It's all hard not, it's really hard not to. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I do think that that's the approaching zero aspect is what in the classical world we want to conceive our technique to be.
Mm-hmm. Okay, cool.
Yeah. So I think they align with each other.
That's good.
And also you could say that, you know, as a 33, 34 year old in a classical music, that's also in some ways considered a baby too. Mm-hmm. There's a long trajectory, or maybe it's getting into the golden years, but it's, you know.
I love that part of our life that it's, we just have a longer mm-hmm. initial climb than a lot of people do career-wise. Like a lot of people our age might be already in coast mode, which is fine. If they're happy coasting this way, then they're coasting. But I'm trying not to coast yet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was actually a big reason I didn't take any auditions this past year. I have met so many golden years people, like actual golden years people who just seem miserable in their job. Like they always thought they should have gotten somewhere that they never did. And I just wanted to appreciate the jobs that I had, because ideally I'd have a full-time orchestra job, but like it may never happen. And I don't want to be that person who's just sitting in the section and so, so bitter and like not even enjoying it anymore, because what's the point?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's easy to lose sight, I think.
Yeah. Yeah.
Are the two of you doing any freelance like wedding work? I'm sure string quartets are big at weddings. And do you do any like pop bands too? Like, do you do strings with cover bands or stuff like that?
So our friend Lindsay worked on a cruise ship for a long time and they made a lot of their own pop arrangements. And we play those at weddings. Patty's like our first call sub for cello. So she does a lot of them with us. But yeah, I guess that's like my pop experience.
Yeah.
I mean, I arrange pop.
Yeah,
tunes.
We played some of your stuff too.
Yeah. Well, but I primarily arrange for cello quartet because, I mean, what's better than one cello is four cellos, right? I'm just kidding. I mean, I don't know.
wait.
Biased over here.
I don't think I've ever heard cello quartet.
Oh, it's a thing.
So cool.
Well. Go on my YouTube and you'll find myself playing.
You can find four patties.
You can find four patties playing a variety of things. But yeah, I mean, I didn't mean to plug my stuff. I just for
no, what is it? Plug away.
Ryan Tello.
I really mean to say that I think that it's important for us to find avenues that are away from classical music. And I honestly, that's where like I think Asia and I probably are really like, how do you do improvisation? Because that's like the biggest limiting factor for us. And it's maybe just a, you know, where we hadn't practiced it. We don't have experience in it. So we feel like we don't really know how to do it. And also the whole thing about being a classical musician is if you play a wrong note then or out of tune, if something's just like slightly tilted the wrong way, then, oh, you lost the job. Like, you know, it's mm-hmm. High stakes kind of.
It's just different. It's a different world. Yeah. And it's about encouraging people to be creative. And when we're like, here we are post COVID, we had that whole culture shock of losing our work. And now we're getting back into this newly opened scene. Be creative. Like, don't feel like you have to just run the same script that you've been doing or that everybody else is doing. You can literally pull out your phone and go on TikTok now and find something creative. Or if you want to go deeper than that, you can make a band that nobody else has or write music that nobody, that just be creative. And I see plenty of string players out here that are doing that. Mm-hmm. And they actually, man, I'm jealous of some of the string players out here. Maybe they did a degree and were doing orchestral stuff, but now they're just like fully employed making six figures with wedding companies because they've created a group that looks and sounds like none of the others. Hmm. But yeah, it's inspiring, man. And I always appreciate talking to musicians from a different, I'm just gonna say different culture. It feels like a different culture.
Likewise.
And it's like, here we are, let's exchange cultures and let's learn.
Well, and at the end of the day, all we're doing is music. You know, it's like we're doing the same thing, just from different, you know, from different, seemingly different paths for arbitrary reasons, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is there a better term for classical music?
Huh. That's funny because we have a similar argument going on with the word jazz.
I was about to ask that. Yeah.
They don't want to use that anymore. You know what? I think that's going to always exist. That's, again, part of cultures and newer cultures coming in and trying to be creative. So I'll say yes. I'll just simply say yes, but it's like, don't feel offended if somebody doesn't agree with you on that. So we say classical. I like that term. But we've often said that jazz, a word I keep hearing is jazz is America's classical music. Mm-hmm. I'm okay with that, but that's also kind of loaded. So
right, yeah.
I'm cool with the words, but I'm also cool with not being 100% married to it because I know that over time it's going to change. Language is going to change.
Hmm. And then pretty related, can you or should you define your personal genre?
No, that's got to be up to the listeners because it's the goal is for you to say that you're just expressing yourself. So my genre is Jason Fabus or whatever other artist we're talking about. And, you let the other people define that. That's the same with greatness too. You can strive to be great, but it's more about, that's kind of that Bach mentality. When you're dead and gone, everybody might be talking about you. Like, wasn't he?
Or
he's just a church organist, right?
Right. But the thing is, he actually was forgotten for a period of time until Felix Mendelssohn found his music. Or I'm sure there's other musicology things that happened along the way.
Shout out, Felix.
but Felix Mendelssohn is primarily known for the Bach revival, is what it's called.
Yeah.
But yeah, he was forgotten. Mm-hmm. One of the most revered of our.
There are certain situations, because plenty of times when I talk to people about my music or finding me online, they want to ask, oh, what is it? What does it sound like? What style is it? And in those situations, it's good to be knowledgeable of genres or moods or styles, descriptive words that you can use to define your music. But at the end of the day, we're musicians talking to musicians right now. You don't need to define your style. You let everybody else do that.
So are you changing your answer to sometimes?
If it fits the the situation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Shall we dive into your music?
Yes, please. I'm eager to see what you picked.
So speaking of a bunch of dead composers that we were just talking about, I have done this before in the past seasons, but it's all been for like dead people. So there's no pressure. Like they're not going to know what bits of their music I chose. So just letting you know, I'm a little nervous.
Gotcha.
Okay, so this is going to be a surprise, I guess.
That's a seemingly fit first song because as we are talking today, and I'll let the listeners know that it is May 17th, it is 5 years ago to this day that we recorded that song and that album, which is off the title track called Splanky by the Jason Fabus Trio.
Nice. Congratulations. 5 years in the making.
Good pick.
Yeah. So I was curious, first and foremost, if you said that with a Midwestern A.
Splanky. Yeah.
But yeah, I picked that bit, the beginning. I thought it was interesting. It seems like it starts on offbeats unless there's something I'm not hearing.
So Shane's guitar intro. Yeah. So Splanky is a popular song by the Count Basie Jazz Orchestra. They would play it in 40s, 50s. I think through their whole career, they really played it. So Shane Savala is my guitarist and Nick Ornelas is on bass. And the three of us make up that trio, which we were just talking about how much we like trios earlier. This is kind of my iteration of a trio that I like to play with, where I'm the melodic voice, but I also have a guitar, which blends both rhythm and melody and harmony. And then a bass, which is definitely in many ways our drummer, our heartbeat. So Shane is doing the same intro that Count Basie would have played on the piano. And you guessed it right, they are all upbeats. And what that does to a listener is it kind of like gets them off kilter, kind of throws them a curveball right away.
Yeah, I thought it was very interesting, but it also speaks really well to the chemistry of your trio, because that stuff isn't easy. There's a moment in Beethoven 9 that's like that. It's in 3 and you hear, I think it's bassoon first on 3 and it...
Present day Asia coming in here. Beethoven 9 is one of my absolute favorite pieces, and I cannot be spreading misinformation about it. So the part I was talking about is not in 3, it's in 6/8, felt in 2, and the bassoon comes in on beat 2, and then you have a measure of silence. So, I mean, the sentiment is the same. Anyway, back to the podcast.
It's challenging.
So you don't know initially where beat 1 is?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Unless you know the piece. But
it's fun. It's fun to do that every now and then, whether it's an upbeat that's throwing you off or like a 3/2 polyrhythm, so you don't know which one you're grabbing onto first. And that's a good example of that. Shane, definitely, when you hear the do-do-do-do, that's a very common intro that we hear in a lot of different songs. So it's almost like that's the cue. So we're waiting for him to throw that at us.
I see.
Good All pick. Right. It's also in D flat major, which is my favorite key.
Oh.
5 down, baby. 5 flats.
Let's listen to another.
When you start with a verse, there's no need to rehearse. Everybody knows just where we are going. But this one little tune, it'll cause a great scene. When you hear a flat 9/13, this is a standard kind of tune. It does just what you think it's going to do. Another standard with familiar form that has me feeling nice and warm.
Then that... Yeah, so that's the title track off our next album. That's a good order that you're going in. So that first song, Splanky, goes back to 2018 with the trio. And then it was 4 years later, 2020, last year, that we put out this album called Another Standard, which in many ways sounds indicative of our first album, but the only real difference is instead of playing traditional standards, we're doing songs that I wrote, so original music. And it's the debut of Jason Fabus trying to sing on an album.
I meant to ask you in the first half, when did you start singing?
I think I've always been singing. I've just been a shower singer and a car singer. And so like, finally I got to a point where I was like, you know, most of my, even like when it comes to a lot of the jazz standards, or I should just say American standards from the 30s and 40s. And a lot of those got repopularized in the 50s and 60s with Ella Fitzgerald, Frank Sinatra, Nat King Cole. That's a whole era that I just grew up listening to. So I couldn't help but be singing along with those recordings. And so that's kind of where it comes from.
That sounds like classical training to me, to be like, like, oh, I shouldn't sing because of, you know, Ella and, you know, Nina Simone and all these people. But like, at the same time, I was going to say, like, own it. It's your voice. It's only yours. No one else has got it. Sounds great.
Yeah. And if I can say that about saxophone, then I should be able to say that about my voice. You're 100%.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you, since this is your first album that you're having any lyrics on, how was that? What was that process like? Because, I mean, particularly that song is very self-referential. It's about writing a song and about how there's so many standards they have to live up to.
That's a good example of, like, I don't generally write a lot of lyrics. I'm not a gifted lyricist every day, and every now and then something will hit. And I do enjoy that one because it's a satire. It's very fitting for me and who I am. And shout out to anybody out there that understands the flat 9-13 reference, because that's the greatest. That's a great chord. And we hit it. And sometimes when we do the show live, Shane will be playing that chord with me. And when I say flat 9-13, sometimes he'll hit a different note afterwards. And I'll be like, oh, sharp 11. Like, I'll have to like hit whatever note he hits.
You'll have to improvise what note that he added. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
So that it's just a good song. And there's one other on there that I wrote lyrics for off that album. So there's just two songs on there that I did. I wanted it to be kind of just an introduction to being like, I'm still a saxophone player. That's how I want to express myself. But occasionally I'm going to sing a couple songs, and that's where I'm at. And that's what I do.
What I thought that was kind of interesting was that you're also educational about it. Like no layman is going to know what a flat 9+13 is. Like I do, but you know what I mean? But like,
I don't.
Well, I mean, someone who remembers music theory, I suppose, like, well, remembers that they're just extended intervals on top of a triad, but
it's specifically usually a five chord, that dominant chord,
right,
resolving before one.
Right. So it,
and
it
even
is,
as you
your training is coming
terminology.
Through.
It's different terminology. And that's why it's kind of a, like right, that reference, flat 9-13 is a reference for any actual jazz musician who might hear that might think that's funny. But the song is much more, like you said, educational for the untrained listener too, where it's just saying like, it's kind of bringing up this fact that like, we don't have to always try to be writing the next best thing or something that's different and stands out from everything else. Like there's 12 notes on the piano. There's a handful of chords and scales, and it's okay to use those and keep writing music unless you're getting sued by the Marvin Gaye estate.
Right. Shout out to, oh my God.
Look out.
Is it Sheeran?
Yes. Thank you. I was like, I blanked on his name for a second. Yeah.
Guys, can we just get that out of the way? That case was ridiculous. And like,
yes,
if
I
you've
agree.
Studied any music law, there's bare bones facts is that you cannot copyright a chord progression or what they're now calling a groove. They're even using the term vibe now in a legal court. They're talking about vibe of a song. It's like, I just don't understand it.
They're scratching it. Yeah.
Lawyers don't know anything about music anymore. I'm convinced we're going to need actual, like they should bring Ed Sheeran in the next time there's a case like this to be the liaison for musicians. Cause like he got it. He knew the rules.
Right. Yeah. Well, also it's been out there for like years. I like saw this in, let's say like undergrad or something like 10, 15 years ago, but like there's this video called Pachelbel Rant that is about a guitarist that played cello, and he goes through the Pachelbel canon chord progression and does all these really popular songs of the time. Cause his whole thing is that you can't get rid of Pachelbel canon because, because it's everywhere. And of course, like, yeah, okay, that's in public domain, but still it's the same thing. Like how can you can't monopolize a chord progression. That's ridiculous.
Yeah. It's, stick to your lyrics and your melody. Those are what are most important, and those are what can be copyrighted. What's even cooler is when a song becomes public domain, it gives the artist the ability and the freedom to make their own arrangement or interpretation of it that they can copyright. So I think, you know, you talk to any of the musicians that are already dead and gone, they would be okay with that.
I'm going to just like scrape at it one more time and then I'll be done with it. But like, it's like the double-edged, like good and bad of what Sonny and Cher did, because that's the whole copyright thing came from them, which is that like, of course we want to monetize what we do, but then at the same time, it like also stifles creativity and like, and brings up lawsuits for no reasons. And yeah. So it's just like, there's just one of those things where it's like,
and it's,
you know,
putting a bad image on Marvin Gaye, unfortunately, who like, is a super peaceful dude, I would hope to think. And he put out only good energy and good music. And now years later, his family is, you know, I don't know any of them. So maybe they have reason to fight for this stuff, but that particular case is bogus. And you can't be copywriting stuff like that. And the fact that it's going all the way up into a court case like this and being on national television, it's kind of frightening. So
I think it's because it's Ed Sheeran, but yeah.
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 They come after the big fish. We're all, we're going to be okay.
Yeah. Okay. Next. So that's In a Little Log Cabin from the same album. Mm-hmm. I had to choose a guitar solo because I couldn't just feature you every time.
That's my boy. That's longtime member of the trio and close homie of mine, Shane Savala, yet again. And then our current bassist, Brian Ward. And I can't be more happy and like eager to play with those two guys because they're clearly very gifted. That's a difficult tempo to kind of hold down, especially with that free form type of solo. And you hear very quickly, like if I'm not playing, a trio becomes a duo very quickly. And then I kind of like that you picked that because he's playing a great solo. And then you hear me kind of sneak in with maybe like a string line, you know, just a single line that kind of follows the harmony.
So correct me if I'm wrong, but that last little bit is actually a little bit more part of the next phrase.
Yeah, that was the end of his solo back into the melody, which is evoking the lyric in a little log cabin.
Yeah, it took me until today to hear that. I was like, oh, I have to keep that in there.
Mm-hmm. That's often how I name songs is like some little motif or melody will sneak in and I'll hear a word. So maybe I'm not a lyricist, but I think of titles that way of a phrase or a word that fits the, you know, the little motif that I start with.
Well, I find that kind of interesting that you say that in some ways, because when you say in a little log cabin, in some ways that brings a image of home or an image of being inside and comfortable, safe, warm. And you put it in, I'm full disclosure, I have perfect pitch, but you put it in a major, which is that key has been used in many a time to evoke that kind of comfort and safety and home and feeling warm and comfortable. And so I find that kind of interesting that, was that purposeful by any means or was
thank
that
you
accidental?
For telling me that you have perfect pitch. That's, I always, am fascinated by that. I don't want to say that I wish I had it, but I've enjoyed.
Trust me, there's times where I wish I didn't, but there's time it is useful. I don't regret. I mean, I don't want to get on a tangent about
But. I've enjoyed practicing my relative pitch and getting it to a point where it will never be as good as perfect pitch. You know, perfect pitch is like when you see the color red, your brain tells you that it's the color red. It's just that quick. I might not ever have that, but I'm very good at having relationships with keys, a little bit of synesthesia, maybe like relating it to a color or at least a feeling. And F major, a lot of the flat keys are warmer, darker colors, and F major definitely is an earth key. It's a home key. So thank you for hearing that. It doesn't start.
I can't help it. Yeah.
One thing though, that it does start on technically the
is that D flat. So, yeah. Yeah, I heard that. Yeah.
All right. This next one actually has a friend of mine on it.
Oh snap. Thank you. yes. Curfew Street in St. Paul, Minnesota, the former home of my good friend, our good friend, Riley Helgeson and his wife, Mariana. And that whole song is a little out of left field, maybe to the listeners, but ever since I was in high school and college, I've always been, into hip hop culture and the music and producing beats and how it takes so much from classical and jazz and everything. And it's a great way to, for me, when I make these beats, it's kind of music that I'm making for myself to go back and listen to, right? Those first, couple songs you played, I wanted to give those to everybody else, but I don't necessarily go back and listen to myself play saxophone that much. I like to keep it kind of like I let it go, and then I try not to listen to it too much. But the beats that I produce is much the opposite. It's like I'm making that to commemorate a memory a lot of times. So this is a perfect example of that, because Curfew Street was 2021, the summer of 2021. It's the end of August. It's a hot, humid night. It's finally cooling off. You hear the crickets. And I was just sitting outside with Riley having some beers and a fire. And it's like, that's what that whole beat is about.
Nice. I started where I did because I also just really love the piano chord progression. Jesus. Mm-hmm. Chord progression. There we go.
Yeah. It's whatever you'd like to call it. I'm a fan of calling it G flat major instead of F sharp major, but it's G flat and it's two chords. So it's going from G flat or F sharp major down a major third to D major. And it's kind of going back and forth between those two.
So I find it interesting that you talked about the beat, because that was the thing that my ear focused on most, which it was mainly in 7/8, which are seven beats, which is an irregular form. Mm-hmm. And I was even trying to sort it out in my brain, because there's times where I think you also jilted where it wasn't always in seven. It was like kind of, phased a little bit and then you got back into it. And maybe I think about this because, again, in classical music, more times than not, you set the meter of it's in 4/4 and 3/4 and 6/8, and you just stick with it for the remainder mostly of the piece. So, and rarely is there a piece of classical music that's written in 7/8 the whole time, right? Mm-hmm. And so I guess I was sort of wondering, like, what is it about that meter that was sort of like that felt that vibe in the summertime? Because for me, actually, I was thinking it was something, maybe I was thinking about the winter because of what you're just talking about in the log cabin, but I was thinking like maybe not so much in the summer.
Well, but this was the summer, like during kind of that like mayhem, second like rush of pandemic. We got through the 2021, and for a while, I think when vaccines came out or whatever, and I don't want to get into all this stuff, but like it kind of like subsided a little bit. And then it really in 2021, I felt like we got hit again of the reality of like, no, it's not done yet. And, I took the risk of traveling a little bit to get back and see family at that point. And hanging out with Riley that week was kind of this, it was good to hang. It was good to be back in an old scene and reconnect with a friend, but we were also talking about just the mayhem still that was going on. A lot of violence going on in St. Paul. I remember when we were hanging out those nights, you could hear stuff going on. So
trust. I mean, I live in like Eat Street uptown. Like I heard all of the stuff. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm sorry for a lot of the stuff that you all had to go through in that scene. Cause it's such a great city and you just hate to see things turn to violence.
Yeah. So. Well, there's unjust, then there's unjust, that sort of thing.
It's true. Yeah. It's happening on both ends and it's going both ways, unfortunately. So yeah, it's just a lot of mixed emotion in that beat, I think.
But that makes a lot of sense now, actually, that you put it in the context of it, that it is 2021 and maybe I just like burnt that from my brain and wanted to forget, what it was like back then. But yeah, it's true. It was really unsettling. And so the beat makes sense.
Mm-hmm. The cricket sounds were taken off the cell phone too. So you can rest assured that it was authentic.
Legitimate crickets.
Yeah, them St. Paul crickets. Thank you, St. Paul crickets. And thank you, Riley Helgeson. That was fun to do that with him. And I don't think that's going to be the last track that we put out. So
nice. Look forward to hearing more.
Yeah, thank you.
we have one more
clip
from you.
Memory ain't nothing but a gimmick. Self-inflicted limits got you anti-copacetic. Living in the lab and a past is pathetic. Thinking you're indebted to the person that you was just because of what you did and how you did it. Just forget it. Pick a plot and dig quick, cause life can go by in the blink of an eye in the big pick. And you and I could die before we ever start to figure it out. What's it all about? Funky people know who's about the now. I have a wanna dance too, so hop on the floor before life's past you. Or past me, the past me's trying to ask me what the future's holding, but I'm living for the moment. I don't claim to be a prophet or a poet or a person who ain't searching for what makes the world keep turning, burning all the bad habits while I'm cursing at the version of me yesterday. You said, I said, who led our way to now?
Moving through my time only proves that I don't exist behind the moment I'm bleeding into. Living life between the future and what's been delivers me to now.
Yeah!
No! Shout out to my then 5 years old, now 8 years old nephew, Declan, in Wisconsin, for hopping on that track when he didn't even know what that meant.
Does he have royalties? Is he getting?
Yeah, he's going to come after me.
Yeah, exactly.
Hey, Uncle Jason. that's fitting because the one we just played, Curfew Street, you know, I was saying maybe that's like the second wave of pandemic, the 2021 version. But this one was coming out summer of 2020, which is when it was all really hitting us for the first time. So that's a song that I wrote many years before that. And just never, I had it sitting in my old, you remember Asia when we had those old Minnesota notebooks that had like all the staff paper in them?
Yeah.
That's where I wrote it. It's sitting in there. And I think I wrote it when I was out here in California, but still that's almost 10 years old. And just didn't really know how I wanted it to come out. And that's, you know, summer of 2020, I made that version of it. And the MC and the lyricist that you're hearing on there is a guy named Adam Werlein, who's a longtime friend of mine from Milwaukee. He goes by the artist name Diamato. I've had him do several tracks with me. We keep our paths keep crossing as the years go by. So
I love it when that happens. That's like a meant to be situation. Yeah.
Yep. I trust those types of situations.
Is there anything else you'd like to share about what we heard?
I think what he's saying there is pretty much hitting the nail on the head. It's about living in the moment. And I'm always been an advocate of that and preaching that. And it doesn't mean not living so much in the moment that you're not getting shit done or being unorganized, but it means take a moment to like appreciate little things every day and be grateful for that. Have gratitude for being alive, present, conscious, and able to make music or do whatever you need to do to express yourself. So I'm a huge advocate of that. It all started when I read The Power of Now by Eckhart Tolle, which is a popular book I'm sure a lot of people have read. And then allowing that, it's a good book actually to read because he references plenty of other people like Alan Watts and, you know, other books like Brave New World, Aldous Huxley. It kind of gets you going. He gets you going on the whole path of whatever you want to call it, living in the moment, being present, attitude of gratitude, all that good stuff.
Yeah, that's great stuff. So what's next for you, Jason?
It's been a good year of just like getting back to the freelance grind. LA is a huge freelancer city, just like, and I think in many ways, all big cities have that. And it's been good to jump back in on working gigs like that. But the last 2.5 years of pandemic really encouraged me to keep on my path of writing music, producing music, and following the artist that's inside me. And I just want to like slowly, as the years go by, shift more towards that. So I'm going to keep doing that. Right now, though, it's been a lot of work just, you know, with LA and the scene jumping back in. It's going to be a busy summer, but I want to do more traveling and more writing. I'm getting simpler with my long-term views, I think. But isn't that the case?
Yes, one would hope.
That's a close-up kitty.
It is a close-up kitty. If people want to hear more of your music, where can they find you?
Yeah, I implore more musicians to tell non-musicians that like Spotify and Apple Music and YouTube, that should be our social media. Like, you don't need to have hundreds of thousands of followers on Instagram, because those followers aren't going to show up at your show. You need real dedicated fans to listen to your music and find what you're writing. So I'll start there. I've got Jason Fabus, F-A-B-U-S, on Spotify or wherever you stream your music. And then my most popular group, as we heard in the first two clips, is the Jason Fabus Trio. You can also look that up. And then the beats that I produce are under the moniker JFAB, J-F-A-B. So you can look any of those up. And if you want to say, hey, all my links to social media and my emails are included on that stuff. So go find me and say hello.
That's a convenient, like, side name is JFAB.
JFAB.
I mean, I can't, it's like P-Raw. Like, that doesn't work.
Well, that goes all the way back to my old homie, Tim, that I knew growing up in Milwaukee, who's a huge fan of rap and kind of helped get me into that music. And he made up the name. He goes, JFAB, JFAB well, Productions. There
you, that's the best way. That's the most authentic ways from your friends. Yeah.
Yep.
Well, it's been great to have you on Pour Me a Mozart. Thank you for taking the time to share your music with us. And cheers.
Cheers. Thank you.
And I'll see you out in Minneapolis. Oh, excuse me, St. Paul soon.
Either or.
Which one? It doesn't matter. Well, like, subscribe.
Yeah. Pour Me a Mozart is on Instagram and Facebook at Pour Me a Mozart. You can email us at pourmeamozart@gmail.com. Please rate on iTunes. I think you can rate and write reviews on Spotify.
I think so. Yeah.
If you're feeling extra generous, the Patreon is active again. It is, surprise, surprise, at Pour Me a Mozart. Follow us all the places.
Yeah. And tell your friends and family.
Yes, please.
On the next episode of Pour Me a Mozart, we'll hear from oboist extraordinaire, composer, and jazz guy, Jeff Paul.
I remember in my audition process for various conservatories, there were other higher profile teachers who said very point blank, like, if you come here, you're not playing saxophone, you're not playing piano, you're not composing, you're not doing jazz, right? But Mr. Kilmer in particular was very clear about, yes, do all of that. That only strengthens your musicianship. And not every musician should be the same.